Bill Records. This five-track collection captures the artist's journey through self-discovery and relationships in his early 20s, showing a growth from his 2017 debut, Luminosity. Now 28, Hubbard describes this EP as the culmination of his evolving sound, blending soulful harmonies, layered fingerstyle guitar, and genre-bending instrumentation. While rooted in pop folk, the record explores fresh influences like alternative, reggae, hip-hop, and country, balancing creative freedom with a clear pop sensibility. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the release radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visitkingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream I Won't Lie on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
I'm doing fine. Again, stop seeing all my friends. I was stuck in my head about the way someone said I look like a mess. Now I know what they meant. Man, I just need some rest. Probably meant me the best. Yeah, I've been on stupid now. You don't gotta worry what I'm working on. Those days are gone. Can't hear anybody tell me wrong. I think I just need a break. Put me on a boat in a big old lake. Can't help myself, I'm doing fine. Yeah, I'm feeling good, no, I won't lie. I got the recipe, wherever I'm cooking is the place to be. Not like obsessively, we'll have a good time on any street. If you wanna ride with me, gotta find time for the comedy. Have the kind of attitude, a little bit of authenticity. Can't help myself, I'm doing fine. Yeah, I'm feeling good, no, I won't lie.
CFRC listeners, this is Christina Laurie, CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative news reporter. CFRC's annual funding drive campaign is now underway through December 31st, and you can help CFRC keep our listeners informed on issues that matter with modernized broadcasting equipment and trained team members. Help CFRC hit our $25,000 fundraising goal this year by donating today at cfrc.ca. Good morning. It is 11 a.m. on Friday, December 13th, and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Currents. CFRC's news programming is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. At the last Environment, Infrastructure, and Transportation Committee meeting, members unanimously approved additional efforts to prevent, remove, and report graffiti. The report and recommendation for further action presented to the committee came from the city's Commissioner of Infrastructure, Transportation, and Emergency Services, Brad Joyce. It is estimated that the city deals with over 750 vandalism graffiti incidents annually, at a cost of approximately $250,000. Some of the most frequently targeted areas singled out in the report include the downtown core, Shannon Park, Victoria Park, Lyon Civic Gardens, Waven Crossing, and bus shelters. while a touch of spray paint may just seem like an eyesore at most. Commissioner Joyce claims vandalism can have a significant negative impact on the city's image, make public spaces feel less safe, and destroy public amenities. This concern is heightened when it comes to what the city has classified as hate graffiti, referring to symbols, images, or texts that promote hate, discrimination, and violence. The report also states that these crimes, which fall under the large umbrella of mischief offenses, go largely unreported with little, if any, consequence to offenders. At the committee meeting reviewing the report, Williamsville Councilor Vincent Chinnani spoke to the issue of graffiti in his district, especially concerning business owners.
That's one of the big complaints I get is graffiti, especially during the summer, not so much during winter, but because a lot of the building, some city buildings, but a lot of public businesses have been, you know, coming up to me and expressing that there's graffiti problems. And even I once caught somebody graffitiing the sidewalks all the way down. But something needs to be done.
While the city currently takes action like using anti-graffiti coating on surfaces and trying to remove graffiti within 24 hours after being reported, the report points out the missing piece is education and awareness. Karen Santucci, Director of Public Works and Solid Waste, spoke to this and how the city plans to fill the gap before the committee.
The one element we're really missing is education, right? Like there's little bits and pieces on our website that say, what do you do if there's graffiti? Who do you call? What department is it? How do I remove it? We're sort of missing that element, and that element will allow residents to be able to identify graffiti more quickly, get it into the city in a manner that we're able to deal with that. If it's on private property, give them some information on, do I need to get a hold of police? Do I need to get a hold of bylaw? And how do I remove that? So I think it will add elements that we don't have from the public's use and also from internal city staff in terms of how do I make sure that all of these pieces that we have are in one place that everyone can see what our graffiti program is in totality and that can then be used by everyone and not just in bits and pieces.
The recommendation given by Joyce was to develop a communications plan to provide important graffiti management information to residents regarding prevention, reporting, and removal techniques. This would also include information about ways to deal with hate graffiti, available street art programs, and organizing community cleanup programs. One of the first moves will be creating a webpage for the specific topic. Communications-based anti-graffiti measures will be ready for rollout in mid-2025, providing more information and resources for residents. Residents may see a more colorful Kingston in the coming years as the city embarks on a 3-year pilot project to support mural creation in 2025. A report by Jennifer Campbell, the city's Commissioner of Community Services, presented to the Arts, Recreation, and Community Policies Committee, provided an overview as public art policy has changed and developed over the years. Campbell reported ever-increasing interest in public art and murals since policy was officially put in place in 2014, and even more so since amendments were made in spring 2023 to further reduce barriers for artists and simplify the process of installing murals. The report catalogs 16 pieces throughout the city. The city is taking this initiative to beautify Kingston a step further with a pilot project launching next year. In the coming years, the city aims to position Kingston as a center for, quote, creative placemaking through art that enhances public spaces, celebrates the city's identity, and supports local artists. The city's Director of Arts and Culture Services, Danica Lockhead, explains some of the vision behind this project before the committee.
The report speaks to the pilot project, which is really, you know, a reflection and responding to some of the challenges that we heard from artists in the community, from business owners, from property owners, from community groups who are really excited to do and deliver a mural in the community, but really don't have access to specific resources to support things like artist fees, key services, priming walls, you know, purchasing paint, securing the right materials or equipment for installation. And so the pilot project is going to reallocate and dedicate some existing budget that we have in our public art envelope to really support and hopefully, you know, create more incentives for murals to take place going forward.
As Lockhead explained, enhanced services and support for artists will be provided through the project. A total of $150,000 will be allocated to cover costs associated with expanding mural support services. Notably, while previous efforts were exclusively targeting private property, this project will also give artists the opportunity to propose murals on public property. This work is also connected to the city's latest initiatives tackling graffiti, providing more opportunities for creative expression and covering blank surfaces, which have a high risk of being tagged with art. The pilot project will be moving forward in 2025 with unanimous support from the committee. Lockhead had the following closing remarks.
I think if we see larger scale mural projects, there's going to be, you know, a clear demonstration of the benefit of these murals, both in the public realm, but also to the potential business or wherever the mural goes. I think there will be a larger interest in having these murals in place.
Recent strike votes from Queen's University workers signaled possible labor disruptions in the new year. A release from QP earlier this week confirmed that across three Kingston groups, 96% of members voted in favor of strike action. This includes trades, custodial and food service workers, educational and laboratory technical staff, and library technicians. According to the release, most of these Queen's workers have seen their wages fall below inflation by 11 to 14% in recent years, and many have had to take on second or third jobs to make ends meet. For those in trades, hourly wages are $10 to $15 lower than at other Kingston employers. QP254 President Marie Edwards, representing technicians, spoke to the current state of negotiations in an interview with CFRC. What have you been experiencing so far, and what are you hearing from your fellow Queen's workers? Where is the university falling short here?
The biggest problem among our members right now is wages. The constraint of 1% wage increase over the last 3 years has impacted the members greatly, especially considering how inflation has driven the prices of everything up. So if you look at the buying power, we've gone down in the last number of years by roughly 10% of buying power. So members are having, you know, they're having a hard time putting money away to save. Some are having difficulty making ends meet with rent. We have a fairly broad range of salary. Some of them are having difficulty with food. They're experiencing food insecurity.
Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could speak to the circumstances and the state of negotiations that's brought us here, where Queen's workers are ready to strike in the new year.
They're feeling that the university is not listening when it comes to compensation. There was a request to have a wage opener clause in the last collective agreement because, you know, we knew that the wage constraint did come down from government. The university denied our request for this. And we're concerned that they're going to come into it looking for a similar increase that they've given us in the last number of years. So in the last 10 years, our wage increases have been an average of 1.25.
While it is anticipated that wage negotiations will be difficult, Edwards did report progress in non-wage related bargaining, which took place just prior to the interview. You did mention that you just came back from bargaining with non-wage related issues. How did that go?
That went very well. There's been good discussion on the language and the changes. Some of the changes were to align the collective agreement with language from labor laws, that kind of thing. Some of them were also to recognize, for instance, the recognition of a family member may mean different things to different groups.
When asked for comment by CFRC, the university simply responded, stating they are engaged in separate talks with several unions, and they remain committed to reaching negotiated agreements that are capable of being ratified by the parties involved. While workers are ready to strike, Edwards has hope an agreement will be reached before it comes to that. The latest update from Queen's, since it was released that QP workers are ready to strike, was simply that you're still in negotiations. Do you foresee any change in circumstances before the new year that would prevent a strike?
We're all working towards reaching an agreement to avoid a strike. But the workers want to be in a position where they can, if they're going to strike, we want to strike in a manner where it will have the most impact so that we can get it dealt with and finished as quickly as possible. Because really, everyone wants to be back at work.
And do we have any ideas on timeline?
We have not been offered any monetary proposals at this time. The university has not given us any idea when we might be expecting those. We do have a number of bargaining dates scheduled for January, towards the end of January, the 24th, 28th, and 31st. So I'm hoping that there will be some monetary proposals on the table at that time.
Thank you. Before we get into our weather and traffic report for this morning, we're going to run through a few messages directly from the city of Kingston. Starting off, Kingston's Clayton Ross recognized as one of Canada's favorite crossing guards. Kingston's own Clayton Ross has been honored as one of Canada's favorite crossing guards in the 2024 contest organized by Parachute, Canada's national charity dedicated to injury prevention. Parachute's annual Canada's Favorite Crossing Guard contest, supported by Desjardins Insurance, celebrates crossing guards who go above and beyond in ensuring children's safety. Each year, three crossing guards in Canada are recognized for their significant contributions to their communities. Each winning crossing guard receives $500, as does each of their schools. Serving both St. Paul Catholic School and Lord Strathcona Public School, Ross's dedication to student safety and his community spirit have earned him this national recognition. In a heartfelt response to the announcement, Ross expressed his surprise and gratitude, stating, quote, "I care greatly about what I do, and recognition is far, far down on the list of reasons to do this work, nice though it is to receive," end quote. Ross's path to becoming a crossing guard was unconventional but deeply meaningful. He took the role initially as a temporary job following the closure of a comedy club he worked at during the COVID-19 pandemic. Over time, he discovered that the role was a perfect fit for him, helping him align with his mental health goals, including maintaining routines and engaging with his community. Ross shared, quote, "It became something I never really thought I'd have before, which is a calling. It's the most perfect job for me right now that I could have asked for." Ross's commitment to his work extends beyond ensuring student safety. He's become an integral part of the community, building relationships with families and fostering a sense of connection. "Becoming a part of your community is the nicest part of this job," said Ross. "Day by day, you build up relationships with people. You see all the comings and goings, and it feels very nice to be welcomed in." A memorable moment for Ross involved connecting with a young Ukrainian girl who developed a routine of waving to him, which became a cherished part of his day. "That became the reason I would go to bed early at night, just so I could get up and wave to her," Ross recalled fondly. Ross also highlighted the importance of the role crossing guards play in the safety and well-being of students and the broader community, seeing himself as a calming influence for both pedestrians and drivers. Ross's role goes beyond safety to include being a friendly and welcoming presence for children and families, often assisting with directions or small tasks in the neighborhood. Reflecting on the significance of his work, Ross noted that the simple act of helping students cross the street safely is a foundation for their learning and growth. "Kids can't learn anything in school if they don't first learn how to cross the street to get there," he said. His perspective underscores the profound impact small, consistent acts of care and vigilance can have on a community. In addition to his daily duties, Ross also views his role as an opportunity to model kindness and patience for the children and parents he interacts with. "It's about more than just safety," he said. "It's about showing people what it means to be present and engaged in the community." His efforts remind everyone that even seemingly small roles can create ripples of positive change. Ross's recognition highlights the vital role crossing guards play in our communities, ensuring the safety and well-being of students daily as they travel to and from school. His selflessness and dedication serve as an inspiration to us all. As Ross humbly remarked, "The job itself is its own reward, and I'm forever grateful for it." Thinking of becoming a crossing guard yourself? Check out the crossing guard job description on the City of Kingston website and apply online. In another message from the City of Kingston, more trips, more often. Enhanced transit service starting in January 2025. Change is often the hallmark of a new calendar year. For Kingston Transit, the new year will bring enhanced service and more frequent trips beginning on Monday, January 6, 2025. New early morning and late night trips to employment areas will offer more convenient options for commuters to get to and from work. Transit customers can also take advantage of more trips during busy times, including more routes with 15-minute or better service to more easily get to where they need to go. Christopher Norris, General Manager of Kingston Transit, states, quote, "We're building on the updates made in September to ensure our system is frequent, accessible, reliable, and available for customers to easily travel around the city. Enhancing our network frequency and responding to the changing travel needs of our customers is an essential part of our work," end quote. Customers can explore the new schedules and maps at kingstontransit.ca by clicking an individual route and selecting the January 6th button. Questions or help with trip planning can be directed to the City's Customer Service Experience Team at 613-546-0000 or contact us at cityofkingston.ca. Customers can also plan trips on their mobile device by downloading the Kingston Transit app. Kingston Transit will also be offering free fares all day and extended evening service on New Year's Eve. On December 31st, everyone can ride for free at any time on all routes. Transit will operate on regular weekday schedule. After the clock strikes midnight, you can get home safely on one of the following routes running on extended service as late as 3 a.m. Routes 1, 2, 7, and 3132, Express 501, 502, 601, 602, and 701, 702. Leave your car at home and connect to the many activities around the city all day, including the free K-Town Countdown. Mayor and City Council invite the community to celebrate the new year. Join Mayor Patterson and City Council for a fun-filled New Year celebration in Market Square on Saturday, January 4th from 1 to 3 p.m. The event promises a variety of activities for all ages to enjoy as we welcome the new year together. Come ice skating on the rink, test your skills with exciting games, and capture fun memories in the photo booth. Explore a captivating art exhibit and keep warm with delicious hot chocolate, cider, s'mores, and cozy campfires. For an extra dose of winter magic, enjoy a scenic horse-drawn wagon ride around the square. This event is hosted in collaboration with Downtown Kingston and is open to everyone, so bring your family, friends, and neighbors. Let's make this New Year's celebration a memorable one. Once again, that was a few messages from the City of Kingston. Before we get into more local news, I'm going to turn to our weather and traffic report for today, featuring CFRC's Jesse Bell.
This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. We've got a cold spell heading into the weekend, minus 4 on Friday, December 20th, dropping to minus 10 overnight with a 60% chance of flurries. And then the final weekend before Christmas, Saturday, December 21st, daytime high of minus 7 with a 40% chance of precipitation, dropping down to a blisteringly cold minus 16 overnight. And then Sunday, December 22nd, it'll be sunny with a daytime high of minus 8. This is Jesse Bell with your City of Kingston traffic report for the week of December 16th, 2024. We begin with a list of road closures for this week. Albert Street, Princess to 486 Albert is closed until the end of the year, December 31st, to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Bagot Street, Dufferin to Charles is closed until December 23rd for a mobile crane operation. And Market Street, King to Ontario is closed December 21st from 8 a.m. to 11 p.m. for downtown Kingston activations.
Here are some other delays to keep an eye on this week. Aberdeen Street, Johnson to Earl, expect delays and closures along Aberdeen for a contractor to complete road and sewer reconstruction. Bayridge Drive, Princess to Taylor Kidd, expect delays while a contractor begins phase 2 of the Bayridge Drive active transportation upgrades. Collins Bay Road, Prince Charles to Edwin and Princess, expect delays while a contractor completes phase 2 of the Princess and Collins Bay active transportation improvements. Gardner's Road at Centennial and Creekford. Expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal updates, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Highway 2, Abbeydon to St. Lawrence. Expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. Sir John A. Macdonald Boulevard at Elmwood. Expect delays while a contractor upgrades the intersection at Sir John A. Macdonald Boulevard and Elmwood Street, including replacement of street lighting, new traffic lights, replacement of asphalt on roadways, and a new multi-use pathway south of the intersection towards Bath Road. And that's a wrap for your City of Kingston traffic report for the week of Monday, December 2nd, 2024.
Thank you, Jesse. Now back to more local news. Local production company Branded to Film is almost ready to embark on a $20 million studio project in Kingston's East End. Major productions often pass through to get shots of the city, with visitors including Murdoch Mysteries and Crimson Peak. However, Branded to Film is looking to help the city take a step towards becoming a hub for Canadian film production, with a full-fledged modern studio. In the past 2 years, Branded to Film has already made a significant impact on Kingston's film sector, shooting 2 full productions locally with a majority local crew. They are now leading the charge to build the infrastructure needed for a sustainable, homegrown industry, with Jason Jolly, founder and CEO of Branded to Film, spearheading the studio project. In an interview with CFRC, Jolly dove into where the project started and where Kingston's film industry could be headed.
I kind of realized that Kingston has all of the right ingredients, from location diversity to talent to, you know, young people looking to build careers in the creative industries. And just even the, you know, the cost of land and the fact that Kingston actually had a film office. It's the only film office between Toronto, Montreal, and Ottawa. So, you know, but what I couldn't figure out is, you know, why it was still kind of what I call a place where producers from Toronto just came and spent like 5 days to shoot our limestone, rather than a producer actually setting up shop and shooting what I call like hyper-local films, where they're like end-to-end productions where you develop, pre-produce, and produce films here. And that's really where the story began is. So in 2022, we started the company. We were really lucky to have some really, really influential cultural and business leaders, including, you know, our first two investors were Paul and Gord from The Hip, and who really saw the same vision we did, which was, can we build this new creative sector, which is film and television? And, you know, as a lot of folks may or may not know, is film is by its nature, production is a very diversified skill set. Like, we have jobs for everybody. So if you're into acting, if you're into catering, if you're into wardrobe, carpentry, transport, whatever, we have a role for you on a film set. So that's what makes it an exciting industry. And what was interesting about Kingston is they really had this kind of, you know, with Megan at Tourism Kingston, she really had a vision not only to create the film office, but also is how do we turn this into a viable, sustainable sector.
You gave some background on, you know, how the film industry has grown over all these years. How will the studio bring us to the next level?
Well, what a studio represents, it's two things. There's one, there's, you know, a studio at its core is just a big black box. But it's one of those necessary things. Like if you look at our world, especially we're in a very much a streaming world, is where most people consume that kind of long form content. We're very much a series kind of world now. Like, sure, we have lots of feature films and stuff like this, but the most people and, you know, the biggest part of our industry that's grown is really in that kind of series, capacity. As you can tell by the number of series that drop all the times that people, you know, binge and all that kind of stuff. So where a studio is really helpful is to kind of get to that next level. So yes, of course, we'll, you know, you could shoot, you know, we're going to have, you know, all the things we need to do what's called virtual production. So green screen, you know, LED wall, all that kind of stuff. That's very, you know, modern style of filmmaking with also a traditional element in one of the stages where you can still, you know, build traditional sets. But where a studio really helps is really to scale the business. So apart from what I do now, which is shooting most of, you know, the two films we've done, we shot all on location. This enables us to move to a place where we can start attracting series work. And series, yes, they shoot on location, especially, you know, when you see a pilot of a series, it's all like real locations. But in terms of a continuity going season to season, what you really want to do is when you, those key sets, you really want to have a studio to build those so they're attainable. You know, like if I have in my pilot, if I have a toucan, I can't expect that the toucan is going to be available every day that I need it for the next, not just this season, but season two and season three. So the thing that you normally do is you would, why a series is important. I know this is a very long-winded answer, but it enables you to move from just simple independent film to larger series, in lack of a better word, which are, you know, ongoing, recurring, and which that's when you really see an industry grow. And, you know, when we look at a place like Kingston, you know, Kingston is kind of a magic place. It's very uniquely positioned. You know, 35% of Canadians live within 2.5 hours of here. It's a big little city. Like, you know, it's a city that's at an inflection point. I like to call it the Austin of Canada. You know, it's got a very strong music base, but, you know, on top of that, we've got an incredible nighttime economy. Obviously, we have really great schools like Queen's and St. Lawrence and stuff there. And just the ability that, you know, if you want, you can go to Toronto, Montreal, or in Ottawa, and it's, you know, 5.5 hours to Manhattan, which is all really interesting things to grow. What I think will be, you know, in 10 years, the way we forecast and model our business could be a $100 million business here.
The studio has received support from local businesses and influential figures. with the very first two investors being Paul Langlois and the late Gord Downey from The Tragically Hip. With the project now being 75% financed, Jolly is hopeful they will be able to announce when they're putting shovels in the ground at the upcoming 25th anniversary of the Kingston Canadian Film Festival. 10 acres of land have already been secured for the project, about 8 minutes from downtown and 2 minutes from the 401. Jolly has hopes the studio can play a key role in fostering the next generation of filmmakers and creative professionals in Kingston.
And, you know, if you talk to all of our original seed investors, a lot of them were just like, well, you know, how do we keep our kids here? How do we bring our kids back? How do we give them a creative industry, which is something we don't have here, so we don't hemorrhage, you know, our youth and those kind of, you know, assets to the big city. And, you know, I was one of those kids back in the day that, you know, and my question was, how do we make sure that Jay Jolly, no matter who she is, can stay in Kingston if she wants to and pursue her career in film or television or whatever kind of, you know, parallel kind of creative pursuits.
Producer Mackenzie Lee, hailing from Kingston, is returning to her hometown for a screening of her most recent film with director Ryan Ward, Daughter of the Sun. Lee's career in the arts began at 10 years old at Theater 5 in Kingston. While Lee had the opportunity to leave the city after high school with an internship at Soulpepper Theater and a scholarship at Ryerson University waiting for her in Toronto, she decided to stick around and study at Queen's University. As she entered the world of film, she met her husband, director Ryan Ward, and they started their production company, Memory Pill, together in 2008. Their first feature film, Son of the Sunshine, which Lee produced and Ward directed, was nominated for Best Original Screenplay at the 2012 Canadian Screen Awards. Since leaving Kingston, Lee has been splitting her time between LA and Manitoba, producing several films and preparing to direct her first feature film next winter. Daughter of the Sun, the sequel to Son of the Sunshine, will be coming to Landmark on Dalton Avenue on December 19th. Daughter of the Sun has already won multiple awards on its festival run, including the Audience Award for Best Feature Film at the Fantasia International Film Festival. Their stop in Kingston marks the tour coming to an end. I sat down with Lee and Ward to chat about the screening in Kingston this week.
Well, to start us off, what can folks expect walking into the theater on December 19th for Daughters of the Sun here in Kingston?
They can expect a father-daughter road trip drama. It's about a young girl who's 12 years old who's traveling across Canada with her father, who has Tourette's syndrome and also a power to heal. And she is developing that power, and the film is really about their relationship together. And they meet a group of other travelers on the road who sort of they befriend and then want to use that power toward a darker purpose.
Mm-hmm. And then in terms of the tone, it does have this very heartfelt, you know, bond between this father and daughter. It also has a very 70s kind of vintage aesthetic, kind of a throwback vibe. And in terms of the supernatural elements, the fantastical elements, although they are kind of a big part of the film is still really just a drama grounded in reality, and the magic creeps around the edges.
Yeah, and this is a big question because it sounds like there's a lot going on here. What was sort of your inspiration behind this film? Did you pull from your real life experiences, just what you were interested in? What's the story there?
This film is actually a sequel to a previous feature that we did called Son of the Sunshine. And it was about the father when he was young and he was coming of age and he was kind of understanding what his power is. And that film did very well for us in Canada. It was nominated for a CSA and played all over the place. And then, yeah, we just wanted to continue that story and imagine the father as a father, I guess, in this film. At the end of the first film, his daughter is born and she's stillborn and he brings her back to life. And then in this film, the trajectory of, I won't ruin it for you, is that the young girl learns to use her power, you know. But that's all I'll say about that.
Yeah, no spoilers, no spoilers. And I mean, you've already been in the midst of an award-winning tour. What have you heard from audiences so far?
Audiences love the movie. I mean, I think you captured it. It's a really unique blend of a lot of things going on. So, I mean, our production company is called Memory Pill. We're based in Manitoba, mostly, and then we also do spend some time in LA. But we really are focused on original kind of director-driven films. So I think that's what people have been taken away, is they haven't seen anything like this before. People have been emotional. Some people have left the theater in tears. And again, I won't leave any, I won't give any spoilers, but yeah, so I think the audiences are really just really love the bond between this father and daughter and the emotional, heartfelt tale.
Yeah. And Kenzie, how does it feel to be returning to your hometown?
It's kind of surreal. I was just thinking about it this morning. You know, I grew up in Kingston, going to Rideau and KCVI, and I'm a Queens alum as well. And my entire artistic journey and creative journey started at 10 years old at Theater 5 in Kingston as an actor. I spent a lot of time acting around town at the Domino and the Grand Theater, and sort of just really fell in love with the arts. And so to come home and to be supported by so many other artists in the community and my friends and family, it's really satisfying, because it's, you know, I've really gone around the horn. I've been in Toronto and LA and Manitoba, and it's nice to come home and kind of celebrate this the end of our big festival run back at home where it all started.
And side note, Mackenzie's theater mentor, her old director, Charles Robinson, is going to be doing the Q&A.
Charles Robertson, that's
Robinson,
right.
Charles mm-hmm. Robertson.
Yeah. Yep. It's like, it is like a homecoming.
Definitely. Right around the Christmas season too, so it's perfect.
I was wondering if you could speak a bit. Obviously, you're still very connected to your roots here in Kingston, but going from the Kingston local scene to, you know, I mean, you're still based in Canada, but, you know, that LA scene, that Toronto scene, what have you noticed in that jump?
I mean, I think one thing I love about Kingston is the vibrant art scene. I think for the size of the town, I think because we are really close to the hubs of also like Toronto and Montreal, we get those influences as well, but it's just so packed with talent, not just, you know, in the acting scene or the theater scene, but in music. And I think that even spills over into like the restaurants and the culinary scene as well. So I've always been so proud to be from Kingston. And I think the talent there is just on par with the talent that I see in Toronto and LA as well.
Once again, that was director Ryan Ward and producer Mackenzie Lee on the upcoming screening of their newest film, Daughter of the Sun, in Kingston. The Boards of Health for Kingston, Frontenac, and Lennox and Addington Public Health, Hastings, Prince Edward Island Public Health, and Leeds, Grenville, and Lanark District Health Unit have unanimously voted to merge and form the Southeast Health Unit. The new health unit will cover a nearly 20,000 square kilometer area and serve more than 550,000 residents. The merging of various local public health agencies throughout Ontario is the first of three pillars of the province's initiative to strengthen public health. The Southeast Health Unit is one of the four merger groups officially forming in Ontario. The province is covering 100% of the costs associated with the mergers. Dr. Peter Oglaza, Kingston's current medical officer of health, will hold the same title for the Southeast Health Unit. Dr. Oglaza discussed the merger with CFRC.
This is a volunteer process, so it took a lot of discussions and even at the very beginning, we were even discussing what's the best configuration. I think that's a really important point because we need to, the ministry set some parameters in terms of what that new entity should look like. So one of the parameters was the size of the new entity should have the catchment area serving approximately 500,000 people. And this is exactly what we meet and slightly exceed for this proposed merger. So it's a sufficient size to increase capacity, to again provide more surge capacity, provide a good service across the region, but also not too big that it becomes less manageable. That's a really a good balance between the size and all the benefits from the economies of scale that comes from larger entities.
Thank you for speaking to maintaining that balance, because I was also going to ask, this is still a really big region. How will the unique challenges of each community still be accounted for?
But the important point to consider is that the local public health presence will be maintained in the community. So we are under one large organizational umbrella, but the work done through our staff working directly on the ground with the communities, that will continue. Mm-hmm. So if there were public health inspectors visiting local businesses, restaurants in, let's say, the city of Belleville or Hastings County, however they were, they had their area where they were providing services and doing the work. Well, that work will still continue. It will be under the umbrella of the Southeast Health Unit, but the people and that local interaction will staff to community will be will remain the same. And I think that's an important element, is that that local infrastructure will be through which we provide services in our currently three separate health units will still be in place.
What kind of changes may we start seeing in January 2025?
So I think the main changes that we will see is probably not as visible to the general public. Although, yes, there'll be new name, there will be new legal entity, but at the beginning, starting in early January, we'll probably still have three separate websites. So that's going to be a longer process to bring that all together and merge that fully on that user interface end. But the governance structure, the board will be new, the name will be new. But in terms of operations, we will take the time to plan it thoughtfully, how to then merge the operation between the three organizations, and this is not something we're going to rush, and that is really the intent behind that, is to make sure that that local connection and the work and all the advantages of all the strengths of local public health units individually are maintained and brought into that new entity, and then we in addition benefit from that economies of scale aspect, but without compromising that local connection. I think that's really key, and that if there's anything that I want to people to take back from this discussion is that local connection will remain.
The costs associated are being covered by the Ministry of Health. What exactly are the costs associated with this process?
So there's a multi-year budget for year one for the our grouping. It's just a little over 10.8 million, and that's a significant figure. But it does include a lot of different items that go towards that budget, and that's something that's the key advantage of this voluntary merger initiative by the province, is that these are significant costs, and there are additional funding that's brought by the province. These are not the costs that municipalities have to bear. So I think that was a very, very significant improvement compared to previous discussions about mergers. Remember, we had a 2019 discussion about the mergers where it would be a completely different map, looking at a different number of 10 health units across the province, and some of the boundaries didn't quite make sense based on the local connections that we have in the communities, and there was no additional money for that. So this is a very, very significant departure from that that previous concept, and one that's really very much welcomed by us in the field, by our partners.
Dr. Oglaza stated that there will be more front-facing changes in the health system when the other two aspects of the Strengthening Public Health Initiative come into effect: the revision of interior public health standards and the funding formula review. For now, Ontarians should expect the same service or better.
I really hope that this will provide some reassurance to our communities about what this merger will bring, and that they can expect the services will either remain the same or improve. That's the guiding principle behind this merger. And if there's any changes to our services, which there might be some in the future, that will likely be as a result of other two pillars of the Strengthening of Public Health Initiatives, that we talk about the Ontario Public Health Standards, which is the element that defines all the work that we do. There might be changes in nature of our work and what we do based on that process. So that's something to keep in mind as well. But as a result of the merger, we don't anticipate significant changes or disruptions. We're planning to make it better. There might be some things that remain the same. We're hoping that a lot of the types or way we do work will be better.
That is all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's local news programming, brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street,
and the screening room at screeningroomkingston.com. To listen on the go and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Coming up next for CFRC's afternoon lineup at noon, we have Democracy Now!, syndicated daily global news with Amy Goodman. At 1 p.m., join Corey and Madeline for Close Reads, sharing and analyzing creative writing by students at Queen's. At 1:30, hosted by Samar Kaur, Melodies of Myth is a storytelling radio show blending mini-stories with the rich sounds of Indian classical and Western music. And at 2 p.m., we have Whiplash Anything and Everything with DJ LFN. Stay tuned for all these programs and so much more right here on CFRC 101.9 FM.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear. Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a song from local artist Kakao's third album, Quantum Entanglement, released on November 29th. Quantum Entanglement is inspired by the cosmic placement of the soul in the universe, connected as one with a newly sober mind fueling the creation process. The album channels the focus of intent and inspiration of spirituality in raising the vibrational state of self and awareness in the connection of souls with quantum entanglement theories. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Quantum Entanglement on your favorite platforms and enjoy a selection from it entitled Affinity here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM. We'll be right back. Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present Nolan Hubbard's latest single, I Won't Lie, released November 22nd from his second EP and debut release under his new indie label, Kingsville Records. This five-track collection captures the artist's journey through self-discovery and relationships in his early 20s, showing a growth from his 2017 debut, Luminosity. Now 28, Hubbard describes this EP as the culmination of his evolving sound, blending soulful harmony, layered fingerstyle guitar, and genre-bending instrumentation. While rooted in pop folk, the record explores fresh influences like alternative, reggae, hip-hop, and country, balancing creative freedom with a clear pop sensibility. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visitkingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream I Won't Lie on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
I'm doing fine. Got messed up again. Stop seeing all my friends. All the stuck in my head. But the way someone said, look like a mess. Now I know what they meant. Man, I just need some rest. Probably meant me the best. Yeah. I've been on stupid long. You don't gotta worry what I'm working on. Those days are gone. Can't hear anybody tell me wrong. I think I just need a break. Put me on a boat in a big old lake. Can't help myself, I'm doing fine. Yeah, I'm feeling good, no, I won't lie. I got the recipe. Wherever I'm cooking is a place to be. Not like obsessively, we'll have a good time on any street. But if you wanna ride with me, gotta find time for the comedy. Have the kind of attitude, a little bit of authenticity. Can't help myself, I'm doing fine. Yeah, I'm feeling good, no, I won't lie.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present Ashtray Whispers, the second release from Kingston-based singer-songwriter Jessica Wallowicz, who will soon join CFRC's airwaves through our Airwave YGK Musicians in Residence program. Recorded at Port William Sound, Wallowicz's new single explores a longing for closure and the miscommunication that led to it. With emotive lyrics and compelling production, Ashtray Whispers became available on all streaming platforms on November 21st. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visitkingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Ashtray Whispers on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM, supporting local artists since 1922.
Eulogize me in a song I'll never hear. Lay my bones to rest with your fear. Nothing else can nothing but your withdrawal. turned, every letter burned. I read and reread every word, and I was misheard. So I'll get out of this shallow grave, wash my clean from your name. Oh, disguise me inside cryptic rose. Caught between the lines that we chose.
Weather getting you down? Warm up this season with amazing hot food to go at Old Farm Fine Foods. Pizza, frittata, sausage rolls, sandwiches, soups, and more are ready and waiting to get in your belly. Plus, you can also buy fresh and frozen foods to prepare at home and enjoy a huge selection of meats, cheeses, produce, coffee, beverages, and condiments. Pop into the shop Monday through Saturday between 8 and 5 at 204 Berry Street in downtown Kingston. And don't forget to follow Old Farm Fine Foods on Instagram at OldFarmFF to get the scoop on the latest goodies. Old Farm Fine Foods, comfort food you can count on.
Tune in Sundays at 11 p.m. for Orchestral Maneuvers After Dark with me, DJ Squared. Each episode features a great mix of new and vintage, Canadian and international, new wave, punk, post-punk, garage rock, pop, electronica, ambient, and even the occasional remix. Sweet beats are in store for all to enjoy. Join in the fun, OMD, every Sunday at 11 right here on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Goodman, host of Democracy Now! This is CFRC 101.9 FM, www.cfrc.ca.